next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. This is music from one of the most beautiful of all masterworks, the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. What we're listening to is the music in a way that we don't often hear it. This is the version for piano four hands that was arranged by Brahms himself, I believe, for one of the first performances of this beautiful music in London. And it is with this piano four hands accompaniment that the Brahms Requiem, this superb masterwork, is going to be performed tonight at St. Lucie's Catholic Church in Racine, and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at UW Parkside by the Kenosha, by the Choral Arts Society, under the direction of Jim Schatzman, their artistic director and conductor. And at the piano, playing this beautiful accompaniment for the chorus, will be James and Susan McKeever. And we have had them on the morning show before and are happy to have them back to talk about the important role that they're going to be playing in these two performances this weekend of this wonderful masterwork. First of all, we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Good to have all of you here. And we also need to make mention of the fact that this is a very important year for the Choral Arts Society. James Schatzman, tell our listeners about the milestone which you and the ensemble have reached.
Choral Arts Society is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, which means I'm old. I've been around since 1986, and very excited to be presenting, I think, a very adventurous program this year, but also an expanded program for our 30th anniversary.
Very good. Since we are talking about this anniversary year, I wonder if you could just say a word about the genesis of this group then back in 1986. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances under which the group was founded.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was very young at the time, and just not too long out of college, and the Racine Symphony was looking for an opportunity to present Vaughan Williams' Hodier, and there weren't a lot of choirs in town at the time. The Racine Chorale was in existence, but a fairly small ensemble, certainly not large enough to carry an orchestra. And I was conducting them at the time, and Stephen Colburn called me and said, if someone on your board is on our board, could you prepare Vaughan Williams' Hodier? Do you have access to more singers to bring to bear? And I said, I think I could do that, and called every friend I knew and built them into the Racine Chorale and took our forces from about 29 or 30 to about 50. Had a very nice experience, and asked us to sing again the next year, and it just wasn't something the chorale at that time was interested in doing. And so I've always had a love for the orchestral literature, and so that was the genesis of the start of the Choral Arts Society. We spent the summer calling everybody we knew and developing a board and preparing for a second performance with the Racine Symphony, and that kind of took off. There we were. We were going. That was in 1986.
Wow. So when we look back over 30 years then, we're talking about a real treasure trove of performances and some groundbreaking things you've done, the premiere of some brand new works composed for you, and the uncovering of things that are kind of out of the way or pieces that done maybe, for instance, this weekend, done in ways that are somewhat unconventional. So you've done quite a lot. Can you think about a couple of high points over the last 30 years that you remember with a special fondness?
One of the more recent ones was the U.S. premiere of Adrian Snell's The Cry. And I still have a real affection for the performance that happened at Carthage. There was something magical about that performance, partly the space, the unique acoustic that worked with both electronic and acoustic instruments. It was just remarkable, and I still hear comments from people about how moving that performance was. And built a real friendship with Adrian Snell, who's a pretty well-known singer-songwriter in England. I remember bringing two fairly obscure American works, which has always been a passion of mine, John Knowles Payne's Mass in D, which was a wonderful presentation again, and also Amy Beach's Mass, which for me, I think presenting American works to our own American audience, works that probably never made it to the Midwest from their premieres on the East Coast, has always been fascinating for me. And also some of the other high points are featuring local artists. You and I have had opportunities to work together in arrangements and original works, one of which was published, congratulations, fairly recently, The Shepherd's Gloria, and works of other folks as well, using artists from the area of James Kinchin, featured in Mikado, the Mikado that you sang with us, and The idea of doing things with people who have strong ties to the area is really a focus of mine, and it's one of the reasons it was just so logical to reach out to James and Sue as well. They have been playing piano duo literature most of their professional lives, and to have them here is a real treat for the Choral Arts Society. So
absolutely.
It's more like just kind of what we do.
Right. Was there anything in particular that drew you to the Brahms Requiem as a great way to kick off this very special anniversary season?
It's really, to me, it's a very special piece. I remember being introduced to it in college for the first time and just being stunned. I remember listening to it. I had never heard it before. I was 18. What did I know? And the more I get to know the piece, the more it just, there are just so many levels to go deeper with it. Being somewhat non-traditional in its approach to a requiem, and even how controversial it was when he first performed it, that it didn't have the traditional Catholic requiem mass as a prayer for the dead, but really more of a kind of a deep soul-searching way that you offer comfort to the living. That philosophy, that approach intrigues me, and it comforts me. It offers the kind of comfort to me that Bach does, and it's very visceral. And so this is a piece that I've had a lot of passion for a long time. We did it with the Racine Symphony in 1992 or so. And so it's just been a piece on my radar for a long time. And I happened to be researching and found this piano four hands version, and I'd listened to it, and I just fell in love with it. And I thought, what a great way to present this work in a completely new way.
Right. I fondly remember those performances way back where I was the bass, because I was at Holy Communion, my church, and by the time you had all of those singers and all of that orchestra everywhere, there was no place for the soloists, so soprano Wendy Hill and I had to sing our solos from the pulpit, kind of looming over everything. But it actually worked out surprisingly well, and it was already a work that I knew, although I'd never directly sung it before, but that's when I realized that it's just sublime, and every single page is sublime. I mean, there isn't anything in that work that feels extraneous or like filler. Mm-hmm. It's just all at such a high level of inspiration.
And it's very early in his career. I mean, this is written before. I mean, his only major orchestral work is the D minor piano concerto, which was kind of enigmatic at its time. That really didn't really fall into the literature easily because of its kind of dark nature and its groundbreaking way that he approached and putting that work together. It was the Requiem that really was his coming out party, and it's still the Requiem premieres 10 years before his first symphony. I mean, this is a fairly, in his opus, this is an early work.
Well, let's bring in James and Susan McKeever to talk about the very important role that they're going to be playing in these performances coming up this weekend. First, let's hear a little bit about all of the playing that you have done. The last time the two of you were on the morning show was to talk about your own anniversary as a piano duo team and a really special concert that was created in honor of that. Let's just briefly remind our listeners about when that was and what that was.
Yeah, last year we celebrated our 40th anniversary of playing together. And there's a vast repertoire for one piano, four hands, and for two pianos. So we've just explored that as much as we could through the decades, and been able to work with a lot of interesting people and composers who wrote pieces for us, and always looking for special opportunities. And this one came along, and we're so happy it did. It's wonderful.
So is this one of the few sort of duo piano pieces that you've not ever played before? Is this a first for you?
It is. Weren't even familiar with this piece at all. We've done things with conductors before, both at two pianos and with four hands, and with choirs before, and orchestras. But this piece is quite special, as Jim was saying.
Jim, how did you come across this arrangement? How did you, do you remember how it crossed your path, the fact that the Brahms Requiem can be done in this with this piano four hands accompaniment?
It was by accident. I was at a work engagement in Chicago, and we were working with an academic partner who was doing some research for Racine Vocational Ministry, and the appointment was getting later and later and later, and the researcher was embarrassed. He was in another meeting. He couldn't get out of it, and he poked his head out, and he said, you know, it's going to be another half hour. Why don't you just, you know, there's some student computers here. Go ahead and just look around. So I went online, and I started looking at this season and started looking, doing some research on the Brahms, and I just stumbled on this piano four hands version as I was Googling around, and I immediately thought, I have to do this. This is remarkable. It's exactly what I've been looking for.
Right.
So it presented itself as a real opportunity for us. Presenting this in its orchestral form is just an incredible undertaking and something it's not easy for an organization our size to do.
Sure.
When I saw this, I just became absolutely excited. And,
right.
and the more I heard about it, the more I heard it, there's a couple wonderful recordings out there, and saw that there's a transparency to this, the way it presents with piano four hands. It's just not possible with orchestra. Right. So I became intrigued and smitten very early.
Hmm. Yeah, this CD that I, you know, back in the days when there were record stores around, I just stumbled across this compact disc one day just looking for Brahms, and had no idea such a thing existed, and so pretty fun. Susan McKeever, I know you've done a little looking around in terms of where this arrangement comes from,
mm-hmm.
and can tell us maybe a little bit about the circumstances under which this accompaniment was done for the very first time.
Well, the the first performance was in 1871, and it was in the home of Sir Henry Thompson, and it was sung in English at that time. I think they had 30 singers, and it's just it reveals like a different layer of Brahms. I think a couple points are that there's you can have more precision and contrapuntal clarity that cannot be achieved the same way, you know, in the orchestral version.
Yeah, I suppose when you have that full orchestra and all the instruments, it can kind of, I mean, mm-hmm. it's not supposed to, but it can easily kind of turn into sort of soup, particularly depending on what the acoustic is. And I suppose when we're listening to the two of you at the piano, we're hearing these various lines in clearer fashion.
Yes, absolutely. And there are arrangements of orchestral works, and that's not what this is. This is Brahms' own version of it put together for four hands. It's not identical to the orchestra, although it encompasses what the orchestra is playing. And it's such a great work. It's just wonderful to sit down, even though you have to practice for hours. and the music is so glorious that we're really enjoying it.
And I'd forgotten that, but now that you mention it, it is important to say this isn't a piano version of the orchestra accompaniment. This is, as Brahms conceived it, its own version, and that's probably what gives it even more integrity.
Absolutely.
And I think because of that, for me, I don't even think of this as an accompaniment. And in the same way that I don't think of orchestra as an accompaniment, this is really a world-class pianist putting his own work in a new form that presents the work in a different way. The other thing that's remarkable about this is that the transparency and clarity that the piano offers also brings the choir more front and center. And so the textural clarity is just stunning. You hear these wonderful contrapuntal lines, but it's not 25 cellos and 12 bass fiddles.
And you're not trying to sing over all
we
of that.
We don't have to sing over it. There's no competing for airspace here. And in the biggest sections, there's a thrill for me that is different than doing it in the orchestral, because the pianists are playing out as much as they can, but it doesn't obscure the chorus. We don't have to worry if the chorus is going to carry through that. We don't have to worry if the text is going to carry through. There's just a transparency to this that is, I think, really revealing. Hmm. They'll hear the people who know this work are going to hear the chorus in a completely different way.
Hmm.
With a clarity that they just have not heard it before.
We're talking today on the morning show about two performances of the Brahms Requiem occurring this weekend, tonight at St. Lucie's Catholic Church at 7 o'clock, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at UW Parkside. The Choral Arts Society kicking off their 30th anniversary season under James Schatzman. We have with us Susan and James McKeever, who are going to be playing the piano four hands version conceived by Brahms himself. So they will be at the piano for these two performances. Susan, maybe you can describe, first of all, how long you and your husband have been working on this, and kind of what the process is like when this something brand new to you comes along. I mean, what has this process been like in terms of putting this together and getting ready to then put it together with Mr. Schatzman and the chorus?
Well, we've been working on it for about 3 months.
Mm.
And I started listening to it even before that, and just really getting into my ear. The version, a piano duet version with chorus, a very good one. One thing I liked about this piece is sometimes when you practice your primo part alone, it's just boring or something. But, well, I've got so many beautiful melodies. It's like each part on its own has been interesting for us, which helps a lot.
Oh, I see. Because sometimes you're playing something and it's you're definitely one half of something, and if the other part is missing,
right,
then what you're playing is not fully satisfying. But this is not a case like that.
Right. We're playing pretty much, there's not a lot of rest for our parts.
Yeah. And how much, Jim Schatzman was saying, you know, to hear the two of you playing out, I suppose when you're accompanying a good-sized choral group, it probably means you need to make a fair amount of sound in order to really adequately support them. That probably is a slightly different sensation, I should think, than if you're just kind of playing on your own.
Right.
Yeah, it certainly is. And there's plenty written into the parts by Brahms to give support to the choir. And yes, we're able to use the full range of dynamics that we can, depending on what part of the piece we're in. But yes, we never have to worry about covering anything up. So.
Right, yeah, there's no holding back. If anything, you need to really step up to the plate in kind of a big way. Describe the two pianos that you're going to be actually playing for these two performances.
We're playing on one piano.
Right. So the piano tonight at St. Lucie's is what? What piano
it's
would be playing?
It's a German piano, August Forster. And we haven't seen any others or played any in the United States.
Hmm.
And we found it in Chicago at an organ shop in 1991. And that's the year we were at St. Lucie's for 1 year. And we got the church to buy the piano.
Okay. So that sounds like it's going to be very authentic sounding to at least
absolutely,
a piano from Germany. And then what about the piano you'll be playing on Sunday afternoon at Parkside in the beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall?
And we also have a German piano, a new Salter Concert Grand, a company that only makes a few hundred pianos a year. German craftsmanship and engineering, and only a few are sold in this country.
Hmm.
So we're very fortunate to have it. And it makes a big sound, a beautiful sound. It's very controllable. The action's wonderful and fast. You really can't do much better than that.
Hmm. I've gotten to play it at least once, maybe twice. There was kind of a student recital of some sort at Parkside, and at the last minute the person was going to play, I think his wife had a baby or something, but I had to step in at the last minute and play for some students. And it was a dream to sit down at that piano. And it's like the music just sort of ushered out of it by magic, nearly. And I'm sure it sounds even more so that way with the two of you playing. I thought we should play a couple of excerpts from the Requiem, and again, this is a recording that doesn't have any voices, but we still get to sort of enjoy some of these really wonderful moments. I thought, that a request?
Fourth movement,
okay,
perhaps.
I think we can do that. Tell us a little bit about the fourth movement, somebody, and why this is a high point worth listening to.
I think it's one of the more interesting pieces in the Requiem, and it's a little bit of a foil to the heaviness of the gravitas of the subject matter. This is essentially just a song of praise. It doesn't have the contrapuntal difficulty, and it just is a moment of pure kind of uplifting joy, and then we go back to the kind of the gravitas of a work that's giving comfort over the death of somebody that we love.
So is this How Lovely Are Thy Dwelling Places?
Yes, it is. Yes. Psalm 84.
And it's the movement which gets excerpted from the Requiem most often.
Mm. Yeah, if you hear one portion of it sung, it's most likely this, Wie lieblich sind deine Wohnungen. Again, we're listening to a Naxos compact disc, which captures this piano four hands version of the Brahms, and the McKeevers will be playing this with the Choral Arts Society. So here's just a bit of this lovely fourth movement from the German Requiem of Brahms. Well, one hates to interrupt music as beautiful as that. That's the fourth movement of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms, How Lovely Are Thy Dwelling Places. And this will be performed twice, tonight at St. Lucie's Catholic Church in Racine, Sunday afternoon at the Francis Bedford Concert Hall in the beautiful Rita Talent Pickin' Center for Arts and Humanities or something like that on the campus of UW Parkside, the Choral Arts Society, under the direction of James Schatzman. Jim and Sue McKeever, maybe you can just say a word about the coordination that is involved when you are playing piano four hands versus playing two pianos, which of course also has to involve being musically in sync. But when you are playing piano four hands, just so our listeners understand, you are seated at one piano playing side by side, and in order to not get in trouble with one another or musically in trouble either, I should think there's a whole lot involved and a whole lot to sort out. Give us a sense of what has to be coordinated between the two of you.
Well, I read that actually a lot of performances, the pianists cheat and use two pianos for more freedom.
Mm.
But that's
you're not
illegal.
Cheating.
it's not the most awkward piece we've played together at one piano. It's pretty well written, but there are times when I have to be up and Jim's has to be down. He tries to sit lower. I try to sit higher.
You mean in terms of your hands rising above each other?
I sit low in the bench, so my arm is low.
But I have to be, you know, you have to sometimes be playing like this, and
because
he's under here.
A lot of the time the parts are quite together and occasionally overlapping. And we have special markings that we use in our music that tell us get off that note in a hurry because someone else needs it.
Needs those keys, yes. Access to those keys.
And when we're both at one piano, we're not sitting with our normal technique. We're turned, and so the wrists get turned. So it's more of a strain on the wrist, and you can't use your natural technique a lot of the time.
Because you're positioned over the keys in a different way.
Yes, right. quite a different way.
Get maybe the weight down the way you want to. You have to do the best you can.
Wow. And of course, I suppose part of your job is to mask all of that so that as we are watching you and listening to you, we don't have any sense of, oh, that looks hard or that must be complicated.
Yes.
It's your job to try to make it as easy as possible. Susan, you were saying that this is actually very well written, so it doesn't present some of the maybe problems that something that's maybe more awkwardly written would present. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's true compared with a lot of forehand music we play.
Because we've played so much, of the repertoire, and I think also the fact that we have so much experience, we know what to do to coordinate those things.
Brahms Liebeslieder.
But it is.
We did that with.
Yes, we've
at
done
Parkside,
other
that,
Brahms.
And we played a lot of Hungarian dances.
Yes.
Of Brahms, and Brahms is like one of my favorite composers.
Right, it's like he knows this business very well, I suppose, in terms
Absolutely.
Of how to construct these kind of scores. What about the challenge of putting it together with the chorus, the fact that this is very much a romantic piece with an enormous amount of rubato and so on? What kind of challenge does that pose for the two of you versus a situation where it's the two of you doing musically, in a sense, whatever you choose? You have to be responsive to something else and someone else.
You simply have to follow the conductor. So
thank you.
As he stretches and pushes, it's our job to be with that and watch the conducting, which, of course, adds another complicating aspect of the whole thing, because when we're playing together solo music, we make all those decisions and we don't think about it. But now we have to have an eye on the conductor as we do everything at the keyboard and be listening for all of the expressive things that make it really good.
Wow.
But being able to react to the fact that they're reacting to something that's not them. They're so comfortable working with each other after all these years that they have to move together in their adjustment to whatever I happen to be doing.
That's
right.
That's
a married duo team. We practice every day, individually and together. But I was thinking too that maybe the rubato is easier here than working with a big orchestra, and that the choir can actually sing more pianos and pianissimos than they can. Again, accompanied by
the delicacy is very much possible, and of course there's plenty of that in this in this work,
and the buoyancy and flexibility. I mean, it's also a an orchestra of 130 members is not moved the same way as two pianists. And so there's just, it's just, it's lighter. You can take a quicker tempo. And you can move something forward and back with a little more ease than it is with an orchestra.
Very good. So you do it tonight at St. Lucie's Catholic Church. That happens to be the church where Susan McKeever works. So that's a very comfortable setting for you.
7 p.m.
Yeah. Yeah, 7 p.m. tonight. And then Sunday afternoon, another place that the two of you know very well, as does Jim and the Choral Arts. You've certainly performed there a number of times, 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon. Jim, a real quick word about what else is happening for this season.
It's a remarkable season. We're opening with this Brahms, which I think is a dramatic way to open the season. We're going to follow that with our traditional lessons and carols, done in a less traditional way. This is going to be exclusively the music of Bach, and the course is very excited about that. I think that'll be a very unique way to hear this English lessons and carols with exclusively the music of J.S. Bach. We added a bonus concert where we're going to be presenting the opera, A Mall and Night Visitors. We've presented this a couple times over the years, and it's always been a remarkable experience, a tremendous story about a young shepherd boy who the three kings just happened to stop by on their way to visit the Christ child. They needed a place to rest, and so they stop at the home of this young boy, and it's a remarkable story of transformation. We'll follow that with our second concert of opera excerpts, where we'll be doing music of Wagner and Verdi, and possibly some local young composers as well that I'm looking to and observing some of their music. And then we'll finish with a more pops program with three local songwriters, Jeff Ward, Mark Paffrath, and Zach Johnson, are going to bring their unique brands of music together, and we'll be doing some programming around American music.
And if people want more information about your season, what's your website?
They can go to our website at www.choralartsonline.org. Tickets can be purchased online. Information about our season and guest artists are there.
And tickets can be purchased at the door, I assume, for both tonight's concert at St. Lucie's and Sunday afternoon at Parkside.
Yes, the tickets can be purchased at the door.
Very good. James Schatzman, conductor and artistic director of the Choral Arts Society. Happy anniversary for 30 wonderful years.
Thank you.
And Susan and James McKeever, great to have you here as well. And how exciting for you to be part of this special series of performances. Thank you so much for being here. Here is the closing measures of the beautiful Requiem of Johannes Brahms. Selig sind die Toten, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. Many people think a lot these days about tracing back their family roots, and one resource to which you might want to turn, a book which, if anything, will inspire you to do so if you've never really thought much about that, or if you've thought about it but don't know sort of where to turn or just exactly how to go about tracing the roots of your own family tree, should take in hand a beautiful and interesting book from the National Geographic Society called Journeys Home: Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History. One of the contributors to this beautiful book is the very gifted Andrew McCarthy. You probably know him as an actor in all kinds of things, including such films as St. Elmo's Fire, Weekend at Bernie's, Pretty in Pink, but I'm sure I've also maybe seen his writing in all kinds of different places. He has been an editor-at-large at National Geographic Travel Magazine. Perhaps you've seen his work in The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Men's Journal, and any number of other places. And this gifted writer really offers up some lovely recollections about tracing his own family history and family roots back to Ireland. And perhaps you are acquainted with his acclaimed 2012 memoir, The Longest Way Home. This book, again, is called Journeys Home, Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History. Andrew McCarthy, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Oh, a quick question before we get directly to the book. I wonder if you could just say a word about this very intriguing career which you have developed in both the realm of acting and films and television, and also all of this marvelous writing that you've done. Was it by design, or does it surprise you that life has taken you in these divergent directions?
No, there's nothing by design here, let me tell you. I fell into both of them. When I was a kid, the first time I acted, I said, there I am, you know, and I pursued it. And then later on, you know, I started to travel, and when I traveled, I had that same feeling. I went like, there I am, and I just pursued it, and then I just started writing about it because it was just something that grew out of me. And they're the same thing, really, to me. They're this different manifestations of that same impulse of, like, feeling this is who I am, you know, this brings out something in me, and I'm just going to do it. You know, only later did people start to tell me, you know, you can't do that. It doesn't make any sense. And then it is, on the outside, I think, a strange career marriage of being a travel writer and an actor. But to me, they're sort of the same, other sides of the same coin.
How did you first hook up with National Geographic, and what do you do as one of their editors at large?
And I think an editor at large means you don't write for the magazine very often anymore. I think the title is just a way of just saying we value you and you're part of us. You know, I think that's all the title really means, which is very nice. I love being a part of that. I met a fellow named Keith Bellows, who's the editor-in-chief at National Geographic Traveler, years ago at a party, and I just said I had been traveling a lot, and I'd sort of begun to write about travel in a way, not as a journal, but just as sort of just keeping track of what I'd done on my journeys for some reason. And I said to him, you ought to let me write for your magazine. And he said, yeah, you're an actor, dude. And I said, yeah, I'm an actor, but I know how to tell a story. That's what I do for a living. Hmm. And I know how to travel, and I know what travel does, and I know the importance of travel. Because I'm a great believer that travel is sort of a life-changing thing. It's not something frivolous or, you know, for the idle or for the people with disposable income. I think travel is really a valuable use of time. I don't particularly mean vacationing. I mean going somewhere and seeing and traveling. And so anyway, and then eventually I just said, look, you know, if the story doesn't work out, you don't have to pay me. And he said, oh, well, I can live with that. So I wrote a story for him, and then it worked out, and I wrote more, and then it just sort of grew and took on this life of its own.
This particular book, again called Journeys Home, essentially opens up with a chapter about Ireland and titled A Restless Pull. A young man wanders into his past and creates a new future. And it is a beautifully told story, which actually spans quite a number of years. At one point, you say this: my own relationship to my Irish heritage had always been one of casual pride and affectionate, if uninformed, identification. I thought that was really well put, and I suspect you are describing a whole lot of people who are perfectly happy to be Irish American or Norwegian American or whatever they happen to be, and yet have never acted upon it any further than those kind of vague feelings. Talk a little more about the extent to which you thought of yourself as Irish, and then how that so dramatically changed the first time you set foot in Ireland itself.
Yeah, I think particularly for Irish Americans, there is a great pride in it, you know, and because so many Irish, you know, fled during the famine and whatnot and came to America and found a life. You know, I can't meet anyone in Ireland who doesn't have a relation in America, you know. So, and I first landed in Ireland sort of by accident back in the mid-'80s. I was working on a film, and then I was in London, and I just sort of went to Ireland for the weekend and stayed a month. I felt, you know, that feeling that we can sometimes feel in the world, I felt more at home than I felt at home somehow there. And I loved it. But again, you know, I felt like I had enough trouble with the family I had. I didn't need to go looking for more, as it were. So it never really occurred to me to go looking for them. But I think it's one of those things that happens when we get older, too. We start having kids of our own. Those kind of things start to have, I'm curious. I wonder, you know. And when I did start digging a little bit, it was much easier than I thought it would be, particularly in Ireland, where the Catholic Church kept such diligent records of marriages and baptisms and that kind of thing. Once you start uncovering it, it was fairly easy. And, you know, what I uncovered was I'd always thought I was from County Cork, and it turned out I was from County Kerry, which may mean nothing to us, but it's a bit like growing up a Yankee fan and then one day realizing you should have been rooting for the Boston Red Sox your whole life. It's very traumatic news. And but it did it turned my perception of who I was in a certain way on its ear, and my relationship to Ireland. You know, and then when I went back and I found on paper the land where my great-great-grandfather had been and left in 1850 to come to America. And I thought I'd go there, and I thought it might be nice to walk the land, and maybe that would stir something. But it turns out the house that he grew up in was still there, and it was still being inhabited by my second cousin once removed. And so I went there, and we had this crazy sort of wondrous reunion. She'd called all her cousins and sisters, and it turned out there were, you know, 25 of us on that day. I pulled up on the driveway, and they were all standing on the stoop, and I was like, oh my God, what have I gotten into? But it was a wonderful, wonderful surprise. And, you know, it's very strange. It's like these people are all strangers, and yet somehow they didn't feel like strangers. Family's a very complicated and, you know, can be a wondrous thing, you know. And it stayed with me. That journey was about a year and a half ago, I guess, now. And it has stayed with me in certain ways, and I think it's helped me understand certain aspects of myself and a certain comfort in my place in the world that I'm surprised at.
One of the things you mentioned is that you made this initial trip to Ireland, fell in love with the place, returned again and again with a good friend of yours, and then at some point you stopped going to Ireland. You started going to other places. You said, a whole decade at least went by. You said Ireland was the first place outside the U.S. that I felt comfortable, and that comfort gave me the confidence to expand your horizons. So you tell us you traveled to all kinds of places, nearly every continent on the globe, before you finally made your way back to Ireland. Not everybody has the means, of course, to do traveling on that sort of scale, but even if you don't, that probably echoes to some extent a lot of people's experiences. And then at some point it's time to return to your roots, in a sense, as you did.
Well, I do think, you know, you have to leave home to go home. But just to go back to one thing, I think I've done the math, and I can go traveling for a lot cheaper than I can stay at home at times. I don't think traveling is to stay in five-star luxury hotels. I have. And you can travel very cheaply, you know, and very close. I think the closer to the ground you travel, the better experience you have. I mean, I don't want some concierge telling me my experience. I'd much rather meet that crazy waiter. You know, that's what I'm going to remember. So I think traveling, people hide behind expense and time. And I, you know, I've gone to New Zealand for a weekend, which is crazy, of course. But it also is a fantastic weekend. And I think people can travel a lot more than they do. And I think we should. I think Americans have a fear of travel and a fear of the world that is unfounded. And I think when we go, you know, Mark Twain had this great line, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And I think that's very true.
Right.
And I think Americans would really benefit from getting out in the world.
You also say another interesting thing about Americans. You say that in trying to explain why you initially resisted your wife's urging for you to really aggressively pursue your own family's roots, saying maybe it's the American notion of always looking forward, the idea that what's in the rearview mirror doesn't matter. And I thought that was a really interesting observation I'd not really pondered before. And for someone who has explored this, I think your advice is, if people have that sort of notion or attitude, they maybe should think about discarding it.
Well, I do think one of the great things about America is that we are always forward-looking. And what's next? What's next? How do we, you know, and that's what's made America American in a certain way. You know, the old rap on Europe used to be that it was always looking back and America was always looking forward. And I do think Americans are very forward-looking, and it's made us who we are, you know. But I do think at a certain point, look back but don't stare is a good piece of advice, because we can gather wisdom and or from the past that can help us in the future, you know. And I think for me, going back and looking for my family, and I thought I was the least likely person to do that. I really had no interest. And once I did, I found, wow, it's not what I thought.
Andrew McCarthy's book is called Journeys Home: Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History, published by the National Geographic Society. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Next week on The Morning Show, Monday, you'll hear my interview with Alan Sepinwell, a well-known TV critic and co-author of a really interesting and entertaining book called The TV Book, in which he and his co-author compile a list of what they believe to be the 100 top scripted comedies and dramas in the history of television. It